So back in the time of the Buddha, there were a number of different titles that people used to refer to him. And one of them was the Happy One. It's kind of nice. And also at the time of the Buddha, the some of the records that survive record how some of the people observed the Buddhist community of monks and nuns observed, somewhat surprisingly, seemingly from the records, that they were joyful. They were joyful people. And I think it's meant to be one of the purposes of this practice is to help us be happy, help us become joyful people ourselves. And and it's a certain kind of joy knowing that there's a path to joy, even if you can't be joyful today, to know this is where it's going, to some kind of happiness. So the emphasis often in Vipassana is the three characteristics. And the second one is the party pooper. You know, the insight into suffering. And you know, now I could sit up here and give a probably talk about happiness. What I really should do is talk about suffering, and then the next talk about suffering should be about happiness, because there's this wonderful reversal that happens sometimes. That sometimes the direct pursuit of happiness leads to suffering, but the direct engagement and penetration, understanding, and dealing with suffering is what sometimes opens up to happiness. Sometimes all the different attempts we have to avoid our suffering creates more of it. Sometimes all the ways in which we try to cling to joy or cling to wanting it and idealizing it and, also creates more suffering. And it's a little bit dangerous to talk about something like joy, happiness, well-being, because people can set that up as an ideal, as a should. I'm only a good Buddhist if I smile, and we have this kind of plastic smile that, you know, trying to be a good Buddhist, that doesn't work. And I'd rather have an honest Buddhist than a smiling one any day. So people tend to have this ideal, and they should, they measure themselves by it, I'm not being what I'm supposed to be, and this and that. But then, you know, we give talks about suffering, then people think they're supposed to suffer. And then they think, well, then what teachers think is interested in suffering, and what are they, what am I supposed to do in those interviews after all? You know, what happens in those? And they got to figure out, you know, probably, you know, what are they looking for? And so they're talking about suffering, it's probably what they want to hear. Let me tell them. I got a really good one to talk about, and I should plan ahead and really understand my suffering really well and get really, so I'm being a little bit silly, but the idea is that sometimes when we hold up a positive ideal, people can relate to it in ways that actually can be painful and difficult, thinking they should be that way or that they're not good enough or something. But the opposite can happen also, that if we focus on a negative ideal, a freedom from suffering, that also can, people can get kind of tied up with that as well. I think one of the first useful things to do, if it's possible, is to hold this whole enterprise of practice and Buddhism and yourself lightly. And lighten up, it's okay. So the insight, a very important insight into suffering, and Buddhism talks about that, and the Four Noble Truths talks about suffering. And it's not a few people who come and hear their first talk, Buddhist talk by a Buddhist teacher, and hear the emphasis on suffering, and are relieved. They find, finally someone's telling the truth. I've been going around and trying to get answers, and everyone's kind of has this, pretties it over, ignores it, or doesn't want to talk about it. But here, someone who really addresses this human predicament situation directly and willingly, and doesn't put it aside, doesn't ignore it, doesn't cover it over with belief systems, but rather just looks at and addresses it directly. So the emphasis that is insight is a very important part of the tradition, as you know. But what's not well understood is what I've mentioned earlier, is that the very important part of Buddhism is not the insight, but it is also the cultivation, the personal development. Buddha talked about developing oneself. And some people don't like the idea of a practice that involves developing oneself, because I believe there was maybe a period in American sociological history where the idea of the most important thing that people needed to hear was acceptance, self-acceptance, because there was so little of it. And so there was a lot of teachings, a lot of emphasis on self-acceptance, and a lot of resistance to teachings that had to do with developing oneself, cultivating oneself, as if one is not good enough already. You know, and so there was a whole segment of our population, in Buddhist circles, kind of gravitated to these teachings of you're perfect just the way you are, and there's nothing to do, and sometimes when teachers emphasize developmental models of practice, because of the challenge that a lot of people have around growth and not growing, and people would get kind of worked up around it or feel bad about themselves in some way. And so teachers have found that it was just difficult to teach that way because people got tied up in not being good enough. And so it was easier and more effective to be helpful to people to say, just do an accepting practice. Just accept things as they are. Just be present here. And if you're trying to develop yourself, then you've already lost the boat, missed the bus, because you're trying to get someplace that's not here, and it's all about being here as it is. I think those teachings are profound and useful, but it all too easily ignores the very common human trait that human beings are can change, can develop themselves, can train themselves, and we know that, and we treat children that way because we train children, we educate them, we teach them languages, we teach them skills. We teach them many, many things, and we watch and grow. We watch the kind of developmental stages of children as they grow up. And it isn't like we turn 18 or 21, and that's it, folks. now you're perfect, and now you don't have to change anymore. And heaven forbid that you change yourself, because that's a sign that you don't understand that you're perfect. It continues. We continue to grow, and for example, for me, I've seen that I didn't realize I had so much growing to do until I had children. And then I started, I had no idea. It was so easy. Being in the monastery was easy for me compared to being a parent. The real monastery was parenthood. And I didn't want to grow. But it's part of the deal, forced growing up. So it continues into adulthood, and it continues into old age, and it's quite inspiring to see how people mature, develop, grow, over time. It's a very human trait, and some of you use that trait to cultivate and develop yourself, like to learn a musical instrument or a craft, and you do something over and over again, and you learn, you develop, the mind changes, develops. So the same way with our inner life, that we could just leave it as it is and say it's perfect, which it is, but it's also part of its perfection is that it can grow and change, develop. And if we don't appreciate that, then I think actually we haven't really understood how perfect we are. It's like then we're kind of cutting off part of ourselves. And it doesn't feel good to cut off any part of ourselves. And so being a healthy person is to take an honest look at oneself, see where we're at, and allow oneself to grow and develop in various ways. And certainly that's the way the Buddha saw the spiritual path, as one of growth and development over time. So this idea of cultivation. And so what are the things that we're cultivating? So there's a long list of things that Buddhism gives. And it can be, if I was going to list all the things that the Buddha mentioned you could cultivate on the path, you'd probably get just discouraged. Luckily, a lot of things that you cultivate, if you cultivate one thing, the other things follow along. So you don't have to, even though lists are long, doesn't mean you have to do them all. One of the things that is very important for this process of confronting suffering, working through suffering, freedom from suffering, is cultivating a sense of well-being. And I like the word well-being because it's a vague word. It's not like a technical Buddhist word. It's an umbrella term that covers a lot of different other concepts. So, you know, it could be happiness, joy, could be contentment, delight, gladness, maybe a sense of satisfaction, even a sense of rightness. Sense of rightness feels very good. I remember my first one of my early Zen teachers. He was introduced to Zen meditation, Zazen, in college. And the first time he sat, you know, in Zen, you're not supposed to move. You sit, they can take, you know, this pretzel posture, and then you're not supposed to move. Like, it was an athletic college student, and so it's kind of hard for your athletic and tight to sit into cross-legged for a little. So he had a tremendous amount of pain sitting there, that first session of meditation. But for the first time in his life, he said, he felt real. And that's quite something. So that's unfortunate that that's what it took to feel real. But that's what hooked him onto Zen. He became a Zen practitioner, now a Zen teacher. And so the satisfaction, the rightness, the meaningfulness of being real maybe fits under this category of well-being, even though maybe conventionally it doesn't look like well-being because you're sitting there in pain. But there's something honest about that. So to cultivate a sense of well-being as part of the path. Another word I like is ease. I love the word ease. To have a sense of ease, to find ease. I like ease more than peace. Because ease feels more like, peace is just, you can just sit there and be peaceful. Ease, in my mind, has more to do, you know, it also translates to how you do things in the world. Your activity, you do things with ease. And so, I guess you can do things peacefully, but ease also has a kind of, in my mind, my vocabulary has a sense of grace I like the word ease a lot. And so, to look and to see how can we cultivate ease, how can we cultivate well-being as part of the path? And one of the ways to do that is to appreciate that that's useful. What we appreciate tends to be what we validate, what we notice, and what gets strengthened. So if all you notice is your suffering, it's possible that actually you're validating the suffering and reinforcing it in a certain way. And I know that some people, especially if they don't have a strong sense of practice, they can get mired in their suffering and then you suffer, and then you feel angry at your suffering, and therefore you're afraid of your suffering or upset. And then you suffer more, and that gives you more cause to be upset more, and then just becomes this kind of spiral downwards. If that's what's validated, that's what's seen as being important. Some people find that suffering is that they get attached to it. They don't want to give it up. They orient themselves to it, to suffering, because that's what they're used to. Maybe growing up there was a lot of suffering, unfortunately, but it became kind of like their reality. It's kind of like what they got used to and how they understood themselves in relationship to other people, how they understood themselves that way. And so a sense of identity, a sense of orientation in the world can be through one's depression, through one's fear, through one's pain that one carries with one. And so there can be a certain attachment to it. And I've known people, especially on retreats where we see ourselves more deeply, I've known people who have been surprised to discover that they were holding on to their suffering. They didn't want to let it go. It was, you know, they were on the cusp of being able to kind of put it down, but they didn't want to. It was frightening to let it go. So sometimes, you know, we can validate or acknowledge or be with suffering in such a way that it reinforces it. And it's possible then to appreciate and acknowledge well-being and have that become strengthened. So what I'd like to propose is that you all know the expression, I think you all probably all know the expression in English, that glass is the glass half full or is the glass half empty? That's as far as the story goes there. But what if the glass was a quarter full? Is it a quarter full or is it three quarters full? What if the glass was nine-tenths empty? Is it nine-tenths empty or one-tenth full? You could say it different ways, right? So what about, how are you? Are you 100% suffering all the time? Or are you 100% happy all the time? Or is there some mix in any given time? Depending on what you look at and what you orient yourself towards, is there pleasure or is there suffering? Is there comfort? Is there a sense of well-being? Is there appreciation? Or is there disgust and sadness or upset or whatever going on? Which do you focus on? Which of those two? And what I'd like to propose is that in any given situation you find yourself in, if you look around, in some corner of the situation at least, there's something to appreciate. There's something that brings a sense of well-being or some delight or pleasure in the situation. And now I know that I've been mired in my own depression, mired in my own upset and various things. It's hard to look beyond that and see that. So what I'm saying might be hard sometimes, but it isn't always that way. Sometimes it's because the tremendous capacity, you all have such a tremendous capacity for concentration. If you could just use that concentration for something else besides thinking. And so we get locked into what our concerns are about and stuff, but if somehow we could step back a little bit and look around, what else is going on? I remember in my early Zen practice days, I had a lot of suffering, and the joy or the delight or the well-being or various things, a variety of things, ways in which it kind of just came to me, I think because I needed it so much, and literally feeling the breeze against my cheek, I'd feel like it was a compassion kind of brushing me. Or if I'd look at the Rainbow Zen Center, certain artwork that I would see, and I see in the artwork something very meaningful and pleasant and enjoyable to look at. And there's this one statue at Zen Center that I thought for sure was it was an abstract statue of compassion. And many years, after being there for many, many years, someone actually told me what it was. And it was a statue of a flame, like a 5-foot flame, someone carved out of wood. But because it kind of, you know, goes up kind of like narrow and tall, I always thought that it was kind of sensuous and elegant. And what I saw was in that, not a flame, but somehow an abstract embodiment of compassion. And I used to find a pleasure, enjoyment from seeing that every morning when I would walk by it. And it began shifting me a little bit. There was kind of a little bit of nourishment from that. So is there a healthy way, appropriate way, to allow yourself to be nourished by the small moments of delight, of happiness, of well-being that's here, that's around you at any given time? By no means to deny the difficulty and the suffering and the pain that's here. That wouldn't be healthy either. But to change the context, to change the orientation, to kind of open it up a little bit and not be so locked in and around this particular story, this particular event, my particular self-obsession, whatever it might be. So are there ways of cultivating well-being? I think yes, there are. Buddhism teaches a variety of them, and this developmental model that Buddha taught did not begin with meditation. I know many people in the West, it's taught this way, and often people come to Buddhism that way, where they get interested in meditation first and foremost. But the traditional way of practicing is you don't start with meditation, but you lay the foundation for meditation by being ethical. And not ethical because you're supposed to be, you know, an uptight moral person, but ethical because you can be a relaxed and happy person. There's something about a sense of well-being and joy that can come when we can feel good about our hearts, good about our conscience, and not feel like we have, you know, haven't done anything that anybody could blame us for. And kind of feel good about ourselves. And I've talked to a lot of people here in the West who, when you ask them to list a few of the things about themselves that they feel good about, what are some of your good deeds you've done over your life, and what are some of your good qualities? Some people freeze with that question, because to answer that question, they think, means now I'm going to be selfish. And heaven forbid that I be selfish and kind of admit that I have good qualities, because sometimes in certain parts of our culture, that's just frowned upon, that kind of approach. But in traditional Buddhism, the idea that you would feel happiness and delight from the good things you've done is considered part of the nourishment for creating a kind of this foundation of well-being. And the same thing with the practice of generosity. To actually do things. No, don't wait until... Don't just sit there expecting to be happy. But rather do things that maybe give you some chance to feel good about yourself. And open your heart in certain kind of ways. And so the traditional thing is the practice of generosity is supposed to support this. when the Buddha talks about some of the reasons to practice generosity, one of the highest reasons or motivations, oddly enough, is not for the sake of the person you're giving it to things to, but for your own sake. It does something to cultivate and develop your own heart. And then meditation practice is also meant to cultivate a sense of well-being. And in fact, in order to get concentrated, there has to a good, healthy concentration requires a certain degree of well-being, of joy or happiness. Or it doesn't have to be strong, but there has to be something there. To get concentrated while you're feeling miserable, chances are that then you just get tighter and tighter. It's possible to get a certain kind of concentration becomes tight and a little very forceful, kind of holding yourself to something. And I've known people who have, out of desperation, have kind of locked on, held on to their breath, or held on to mental noting, or held on to practice, and they don't want to let anything else in, because they're frightened of all stuff, or they don't want to feel their suffering or their pain, or they want to be a good meditator, and really, you know, concentration is the point. You're supposed to get concentrated, and I'm going to do it. I know I've been that way. I've done my share of huffing and puffing, and getting all tight and trying so hard and trying to prove myself and comparing myself to the people sitting next to me, and you know literally. But by the time I did Vipassana, I had cured myself of some of these things. But I remember sitting in the Zendo at Zen Center sometimes, and sitting next to someone, and I was sitting very straight, Zen-like, serious practitioner. And I had this wonderful capacity, which I don't think I do too much anymore, but usually I would sit with an upside-down smile when I did Zen. So I'd sit there, and so then I was sitting there, you know, and then I had these thoughts, like sitting next to the person, also sitting very straight and upright, and I'd think, that person's not really sitting Zazen. Not realizing that if that's what I was thinking about, I wasn't sitting. what I was doing was kind of invisible to myself, you know. So trying so hard, and I crashed and burned so many times. The battlefield of concentration was littered with my bones and blood and there were not a few times in my early Zen retreats where, the more I tried to tighten up and try to get concentrated and force myself to get, the less I could get concentrated. So then I would try harder, right? And that made it worse. So then, of course, you try harder. What else? I didn't know anything else but to try. And then I just felt worse and worse and worse. And finally, I felt so bad, so miserable, I kind of reached rock bottom. There was only one thing left to do. And that was give up. I give up. I can't do this. It's hopeless. And the retreats would always begin when I gave up. And sometimes it would take 3 days into the retreat before I'd finally give up and just, you know, I can't do this, it's hopeless. And when I realized I couldn't do it, it was hopeless, then something different would happen, something would arise. And what I've learned from that and from other my practice over the years is that to not take too much responsibility for what happens to me when I practice. That I have a responsibility, I have a role to play in the practice, and the role is to keep showing up. Sit up and show up and sit upright, metaphorically sit upright. Keep showing up, keep showing up. Here. I love the word, just say here. When my mind is busy and it can't settle down very easily, I sit upright the best I can, and I say the word here, H-E-R-E, not like a command to a dog, but just like, here, this is what's happening now, a mind which is out of control, a mind which is wandering a lot. It's like this right now, here. And so I keep, you know, your job is to keep showing up. Practice of mindfulness is to show up and see what's here. See what's here. Keep showing up. Keep coming back. Keep coming back. So that's, you know, your responsibility is to do that. But what happens to you when you do that? I think it's best to forfeit responsibility and trust the process. Allow something to happen. Allow something to unfold, to unwind. Allow something to grow and develop. I think that overall, probably it's easier to let the path unfold if we don't kind of watch it so closely. I've also literally sat down to meditate and meditated for, I don't know, a minute or 2 minutes or something. And then, how am I doing? You know, is this good? Is this the right thing? You know, just. And I love this little story of the farmer who goes out to the fields and to see how the corn, planting the corn seeds and seedlings are coming up, and they want to see how the corn is growing. Pulls the seedlings up out of the ground. Oh yeah, they're growing. Their roots are not long. And once you've pulled the corn seedlings out, you can't transplant them back. So that, you know, they probably die. So they say, you know, how am I after 1 minute? You know, am I there yet? So I think I've learned to relax this measuring all the time. But still. So to get concentrated, you can't do it by forcing yourself. In order to get concentrated in the healthy way that Buddhism encourages people to get concentrated, it needs to come with a softening, a relaxing, a calming, and with a sense of well-being, happiness and joy. And it's not easy to have those things develop and happen, but it doesn't help if we are angry with ourselves or critical ourselves for how we are. So one of the ways to show up and allow something to unfold and to happen that I think is often a good beginning place for practice is with the analogy of the beeswax that I've sometimes taught. This is something I learned from my son's kindergarten class. He would, once a week, the kids there would play with beeswax. And they had the shelf of all this beeswax that would be sitting there. And if you, because you don't know, beeswax, when it hasn't been handled, is usually rock hard. It's so hard, you know, the only thing you can do with it, you can crack it, break it, but you can't shape it and mold it. So what they would do, the kids would go get their beeswax and put it between the two hands and cup it and hold it like this, while the teacher told a story. And by the time the story was over, their body heat had softened the beeswax. And now the beeswax was soft enough that they could mold it and shape it into something. And they would make it into nice little animal figures or something, and when it was done, they would then place it up on the shelf for, just they were finished. And I think of these as a kind of three steps to the practice that we do. We begin by just holding ourselves in kindness and presence. We're not trying to do something. We're not trying to attain anything. It begins with just here, I'm here. And to see oneself, to hold oneself with care and kindness, with attention. Even if you can't hold yourself with kindness, the next best thing is to hold yourself with awareness. Just to be here. It's okay. It's okay. Maybe even say the word, it's okay, to yourself. Be present. Show up. Trust how profound it is to just be present. You get to kind of really be here. And that's, hold yourself. Hold yourself. If you can't hold yourself, let the compassion of the Buddha hold you. Or something. Be held. Here. Stay. Let something release, unwind, relax, soften. One of the things that is why these kinds of retreats can be so helpful is that many people are doers, always doing and trying to make something happen and fixing and changing and improving, and that whole enterprise of doing, 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 and just stopping all that is profound. Sometimes there's a transition period, which I'm sure that some of you have encountered here, where it's difficult to stop all the momentum of our life and just sit and walk and sit and walk and just not talk and not be on screens and all the various things that we do. And so there's a transition to get used to that. But and it can feel easier to just keep going. A friend of mine went to her Zen teacher, and she had a very active work life and dynamic person. And she said to her Zen teacher, I'm really busy. I do a lot of things, and it's just a lot of demands. And how do I practice in the middle of all this? Or what can I do about all this stuff that I have to do and have to accomplish, all these commitments I have? And I think he was, maybe she was hoping he would say something like, you have to do them all with presence. You have to do them all with just being really there one thing at a time or something. And he looked at her and said to her, you're doing all these things. You're so busy and doing so many things because you're lazy. So that caught her attention, because what? So the last thing she thought she'd be called was lazy. And so she went home and thought about it for a while, and she realized she was. And what she was lazy was that doing all that stuff was a way to avoid looking at herself and turn around. And so it was avoiding the difficult work. It was easier to be busy and running around doing a lot of different things than to stop and take a deep look at herself. So that's what we do here. So it's not always easy to do that. But still, the image of holding yourself like a, in the warmth of warm palms of your hand, and let something stop. Let all that running around stop, all the churning stop. It can be a lifetime. It's amazing how the mind, it's amazing how patterns of the mind always working, always going, can last over, 100-year lifetime without ever being questioned, without ever being seen that this is what it's doing. Some people, when they come to this kind of practice where they stop and look and see what's going on in their mind, are surprised to discover that they're beyond the conventional tiredness, their minds are deeply weary from all the doing, all the activity. So we stop. We just hold ourselves. It's a profound thing to do. And for some people, just learning to stop and not do anything and just hold oneself with kindness, hold oneself with awareness, is one of the most radical things they're going to do in their life. It's a great thing to do. And then something can soften and relax. So part of this well-being is to begin to relax a little bit, Relax, it's okay. Soften, allow yourself to unwind. Give yourself the time for it. And then, with some settling in and relaxing and being here, then the second step of Buddhist practice is the training part, the shaping of ourselves. And then we can start doing the particular things that might help develop well-being, make us more happy. And so one of the things that helps a lot is to stop all the doing and to no longer treat oneself unkindly, to no longer be critical to oneself, but rather to hold oneself with some compassion and care. It's not an easy task to do, but I know for me that one of the big milestones for me from doing this practice is when I could go through a retreat like this and not be angry with myself. You know, that was you know, I was often angry, and so, and to come to that place where I can no longer be angry was a great thing to do. But then there's a second step, and that is not only not to be angry, but then to delight at a mind that's not angry with itself, to feel some joy of that. And the Buddha talked about this particular thing, that in those moments, in those times, when the mind is not caught in the grip of desire, it's not caught in the grip of ill will, resentments, when it's not caught in the grip of restlessness, remorse, it's not caught in the grip of resistance and giving up, when it's not caught in the grips of doubt, it's actually a great thing to have that happen. It's a really a wonderful thing, and maybe somewhat rare in this human world to have a mind that doesn't have that kind of churning away. And so the Buddha talked about feeling gladness or delight or joy in having a heart and a mind that is not driven by those things, even if it's a few moments. So to learn to recognize those moments as the glass 9/10 suffering, or is it 1/10 joy? What's going on? But to see, those moments in the day when you're not caught, maybe you walk out of here and you go out and look at the sky, and for those few moments that you're looking at the sky, you're no longer self-conscious. Things fall away a little bit, and then you appreciate that. Wow, this is nice. It's nice that the mind can do this. To have a mind which is no longer distracted a lot. Slowly the mind settles down, you get calmer. And at some point it might happen, this retreat, other retreat, some other retreat, where your mind really is able to kind of stay resting in the present moment, kind of like a ball in a bowl, a marble in a bowl, which with a lot of energy in the marble, it kind of keeps going around and around and around and around and up and down the sides. But as the momentum is used up, the ball eventually comes and rests in the bottom of the bowl. So with time, you'll settle, and all the activity it's like you come into the present moment, and you're here. And I've that's happened to me, and I was so kind of much involved in judging and wanting to be perfect. And I had this also syndrome of the grass is always greener somewhere else. So whatever I'm experiencing can never be good enough because it must be some better somewhere else, some other thing. But to eventually come to appreciate that, oh, here I am. It's very simple, maybe kind of ordinary, but this is nice. I'm here. I'm present. It's nice to be here and feel present in the chair and have a solid chair and a warm room to sit in. And it's nice to have oatmeal. I hope it's nice for you. And it's nice to have breakfast. And sitting here and having breakfast, it's nice. And for those of you who have coffee, I hope that's nice. I make the coffee. So so to notice and appreciate what can be appreciated, to be nourished by that, to help that to soften and relax you, maybe to have that help continue. And so then, as we develop this concentration, the ability to stay in the present moment, it's not a forceful one, concentration, but it's more one of letting go into. So, you know, when you let go of your thoughts and come back to the breath, that's one approach. Another approach is to, in a sense, let go of your thoughts and then let go into your breathing. And this movement of letting go into your breathing, I think, has a very different feeling for the mind than coming back to the breath. And it's possible, there's some people have the, you know, the sledgehammer approach to coming back to the breath. You know, stay there, you know, or the jerking approach. I used to jerk my mind, you know, jerk it back, come back, you know, as quickly as I can. But I've learned not to jerk my mind around at all. I've learned it's okay. It's okay to have a wandering mind. Then come back. I've learned that when I jerk my mind, it stirs up the mud in the pond. I've learned that if I notice my mind has wandered off, and be okay with it. It's okay. It's not a sin. And then let go into the breath. Relax back into the breath. It works much better for me. So this relaxation, the coming back and letting go into, and then kind of feeling. So this is where the tangible experience of breathing is very helpful. What I mean by tangible is the felt sense of what actually, or maybe felt. Some people don't understand felt sense, but the sensory quality, the sensations that come into play in the body with the breathing, how the body experiences the process of breathing, the stretching and moving of the rib cage, the torso of the belly, the stretching, the pressure that happens, the release of the pressure, those loosening up as you exhale, the sensations of tingling and warmth and coolness as the breath goes in and out through the nostrils, particular sensations. And so not to be in the control tower, kind of trying to track them, and you know, but rather to kind of let go into those sensations and rest there, kind of like you're just, you know, again, kind of like you're placing your warm hand on the beeswax, you're placing your warm attention right there in that area of those sensations, and lingering there, staying there, let the hand of awareness warm that area with attention as you stay there. It's a softer, more gentle approach than the, you know, fixated, one-pointed approach where we get tense and hard. Take your time. One of the sources of joy that has been very important for me, and I'll share it with you with the hope that maybe you also can appreciate this, is a great sense of joy or satisfaction that I have, that I have a practice. That this practice of mindfulness, practice of meditation, practice of the whole path of what Buddhism offers, I feel so lucky and fortunate to have discovered it. And I've seen so many times how well it works, and how you know, true the path is. And I feel so grateful that I have a path, that I'm on a path. So even at times when things are not going well for me in my practice, I can't get concentrated, I'm not feeling good, you know, just caught up in something and I can't seem to get off my... You say in English, get off your horse? Is that an expression? Something like that? And then sometimes I remember, well, you know, that's okay. I'm on a path. It's a good path. It's a true path. I'll just keep practicing. And I've learned to trust this path. I've learned to trust the practice. My job is to keep showing up. My job is to do the practice. It's not my job to know when things will shift, when things change, when things open up. That happens in its own time. Causes and conditions come together in its own mysterious ways. It's my job to keep showing up. Keep showing up. It's kind of like showing up and making, you know, when you show up in the present moment, it's kind of like, see, when you're in that, if you're caught up in thoughts, if you're caught up in the past and the future, it's kind of like a spring which is in a box and can't unwind. But if you relax into the present moment, it's like you've opened up the lid of the box and the spring now has space to begin to unwind. Something begins to happen. Or the path begins to unfold and deepen. And at some point, in the course of this path of practice, it could be different points in different ways at different times. It's like this. The reference point for doing the practice and finding one's way in the practice is not one's suffering. It's not like, oh, I'm suffering a lot and I'm trying to do this to no longer suffer, to resolve it, to deal with it, to get away from it, do something. But rather the reference point becomes the opposite, which I like to call ease, where the sense of ease is close by, or you have a sense and feel it. And so that becomes a reference point. You know, I just, you know, how do I find the ease? Where's the ease in this situation? How do I do this in a way that's easy or easeful? And that begins to shift that movement from focusing on suffering to focusing on the ease when a person has had a real experience of ease, however small, and that experience of ease then becomes a reference point. So it can be, and this is one of the great ways to make it a reference point, is to have a little bit of ease. Doesn't have to be dramatic, a little bit of calm, a little more subtle than usual. And then notice when you lose it. And then ask yourself, is it worth it? Is what I'm about to do, thing I'm concerned with, is it worth losing my ease? So I'm not saying that any of you do this, but I was impressed by how long the line was at lunch today, from one end of the room to the other, down the big room down there. So I could imagine that someone could be sitting here in the hour before lunch, meditating, and feel somewhat calm and settled, a little bit. And then go down the steps and end up at the end of that long line. And then feel impatient and frustrated. Instead of having the frustration and impatience as the reference point, and I have to deal with and understand what I'm doing, maybe what's instead is the reference point was that calm or that ease, the little bit that was there. And you can ask, was it worth? Was anything worth? Was any concern about line getting to the front of the food line worth sacrificing that little bit of calm that I had? Why is this so important? What's going on here? To question, to challenge yourself. And perhaps it's possible then to realize that it's not worth it. Maybe it's okay to be last in line and stay calm. Or perhaps it's a little different, the reference of ease or well-being or something, is that it's still close enough, still nearby. Maybe you've lost it, but it's not very far away. The restlessness or agitation that arose, you can still kind of see the ease on the other side of it, or intuit it, or feel it, or smell it. And so, if it's that close, maybe it's not a matter of dealing with the frustration, it's a matter of opening up again, or orienting yourself back to the calm and the ease that was there. So I hope that this talk will encourage you to spend a little more time appreciating the simple ways of delight, joy, well-being, pleasure that can come just being here, that are here already, in a way that nourishes you. I hope that it encourages you to hold yourself dearly and with awareness, just hold it, and be present in a simple way. Keep coming back, keep showing up. Let yourself be your own warm palms that softens your beeswax. I hope the talk encourages you to let go into the present moment more. And don't force yourself into it, but appreciate it and nurture it and cultivate the ability to stay present in a kind way, a soft way, an encouraging way, in such a way that it feels good to want to be in the present moment. It's not like a struggle and a fight. And if it's really hard to be present because of something strong going on, which can often happen, maybe that's just a sign that there's something inside of you that needs to be held in your warm palms of your hand. And you can ask yourself, my mind keeps spinning out and spinning out. What is it that needs to be met and held warmly and kindly? And appreciate whatever degree of calm and ease you have. I know that some of what I'm about to say is going to be unbelievable to some of you. So prepare yourself for good news. You are calmer now than you were 2 days ago. You are definitely calmer than you were 2 days ago. And the reason why I want to emphasize that is that some of you have habituated to it. I didn't notice. It snuck in. It's crept in. And so, to you, it just seems like business as usual. This was so dramatic once. I told the story before. So dramatic for me. I went in the month-long retreat. End of the month-long retreat, I thought, I had looked at my mind and I said, nothing happened. it's everything's ordinary. I'm ordinary. It was a wasted month. And it was a self-retreat. So I didn't have any reference points except my own mind, right? So, and then I went down to the office of the retreat center to check out. And I couldn't speak. And then I realized, I'm not so normal. Anyway, so you're all calmer than you. So it's really something to watch and be with you. So appreciate, hopefully this talk, well-being, happiness, ease, kindness, holding yourself gently, will set a good foundation for the practice over the next days. And then in about 3 days, there'll be a talk on suffering. Right, because we'll do the three cultivations, and then the three insights. But then the idea is the insight into suffering, the addressing suffering, is really built on and supported by the cultivation, the connection to well-being of some kind or other. So let's regather ourselves.